Bless you, Dave.
Thank you, Dale. Good morning, everyone, this morning. Welcome to the service and all the visitors. Nice to have my mom and dad and my sister here, so thanks for coming. Bear with me, let's set up briefly, real quick. I was talking to Dale last Sunday, and I was telling him that God is showing me a lot right now, and there's something I want to share sometime, but I'm not quite ready. Well, then Tuesday morning, he sends me a text, wants to know if I want to preach on Sunday. So I was like, well, I guess God's telling me I need to get ready fast, so I'm here. One of the thoughts I've been thinking a lot about recently is teams, teamwork, church, and working together as a group. I read the book not long ago, The Five Dysfunctions of a Team. I'm not sure if any of you guys read it in here. Anybody? Steve, a little bit? Well, good, then. It should be good, then. And one of the main things in there was no teams working together. And when you think of a church body, what do you think of? Anybody? When you think of a church or the body of a church, what do you think of?
A group of people.
A group of people. That's what I was looking for. What about a community? Again, group of people, or a team. It's all a group of people. They all have the same thing in common. There's anywhere where there's a community, a church, or a team, there's people coming together to do or reach a common goal or a common cause. So we know that communities have dysfunctions. We know that teams have dysfunctions. What about the church? The church have dysfunctions? Yes, I believe so. So this morning I'm going to go through the five main dysfunctions that we have in teams, in communities, and, yes, in churches. So the first one I want to touch on is going to be the absence of trust. So I'm going to stick them up here so we can see them. So the first one, absence of trust. I'm a very visual learner, so I like things to look at. So is there in the church today an absence of trust? I would say so. Yes, sadly, but it's true. Where does mistrust come from? Anybody have an answer to that? Where does mistrust come from? Why do we mistrust?
Fear.
Fear. That's good. Think alike. I can see that. Are we born with the natural distrust towards people? Is that something that automatically comes? No, I don't believe it is. I think distrust comes through life, through experience. People letting us down, people hurting us, we tend to mistrust people. And the sad part is that happens in the church. If there's an absence of trust, people are not willing to be vulnerable. They conceal their weaknesses and mistakes from one another. They jump to conclusions about intentions of others without attempting to clarify them. They fail to recognize and tap into one another's gifts and experiences. They waste time and energy trying to manage each other's behavior. We hold grudges or get offended, dread going to church functions or church meetings, and find reasons to avoid spending time with each other. And they don't speak up and challenge one another. Do any of those sounds familiar? From past experiences, hopefully not in our church, but I'm not going to say no. It's very common in churches to hide your mistakes from one another because you don't want to feel weak. You don't want people to see that you're not who you want to be. Jump to conclusions about intentions of others without attempting to clarify. A lot of people do that. They see someone do something right away, they jump to a conclusion without even asking the person what or why. Hold grudges or get offended. Now, I'm not saying these things never happen, but if we follow the principles of trust, we shouldn't be getting offended or holding grudges towards other people. And I'll go into more of that later. Members of a great body trust one another on a fundamental and emotional level. They are comfortable being vulnerable with each other about your weaknesses, mistakes, fears, and behaviors. They are not afraid to go straight to the point because they are completely open with one another without fear filters or fear of misunderstandings. Building trust takes time. It doesn't happen overnight, and once it's achieved, it must be maintained. I'm going to read a lot from my notes because it's a lot to keep in my mind, so if you don't mind, I'm going to look down a lot, but I'll try to keep looking up. However, when a trust is in place, each individual in the group becomes a stronger person because he or she is part of an effective, cohesive group. When people trust each other, the group can achieve truly amazing things. Right now at work, if you don't know, I manage a company where we manufacture aluminum fencing and railing, and I have close to 30 employees. And my goal right now is to free myself from having to be out there all the time and control every single function of the team. So I'm trying to pull my team leaders in, and I'm actually going through all these dysfunctions with them, trying to get them to build their own little teams around each of their own little cells. And one of the biggest things we face there is this whole trust thing. I know in a workplace it's a little different than a church, but in the workplace, people are constantly trying to one-up each other, trying to make themselves look good, and half the time by doing that, you're pushing somebody else down. So this is a big one I'm really trying to drill home with them. And trust, and part of trusting is being willing to be vulnerable. And the biggest point of being vulnerable is we have to be willing to open ourselves up for criticism or someone else speaking to our lives. The definition of vulnerable is susceptible to physical or emotional attack or harm. It doesn't sound very comforting, but in the church body or in the church group, we have to be open and willing to be vulnerable, to open ourselves up and lay ourselves out to each other, for each other to speak into each other's lives. If we don't, we're never going to build that trust. If you have somebody come in and struggling with something in their life and they feel like they don't want to open up and share this because they think everybody else is going to look down at them or think they're somebody else. But if we're willing to open ourselves up and be vulnerable and say, look, this is where I'm at. I've struggled here. You're actually paving the way for your brother or sister to come up and say, I'm the exact same place. I struggle with the exact same thing. Can someone grab me a glass of water? Only through being vulnerable can we build trust and become an effective body. What do we fear of being vulnerable? Why do we fear being vulnerable? Some of the couple points I thought of right away were, what are people going to think of me is a big one. They're going to think I'm weird. He's going to think I'm some terrible, terrible sinner. Or they'll never ask me to help or do something again if we're being open and honest and vulnerable. A lot of these points all come down to one thing, and that's this fear of man, fear of pride. It's come down to pride, being fearful of what people are going to think of you. But if we're willing to lay down our pride, be vulnerable, open ourselves up to one another, that trust factor is going to skyrocket. Thank you. And these are all valid fears. I mean, many of us have, been burned by these in the past, opening ourselves up to somebody else, only to find out down the road that that person came around and, said something else against you or have been hurt by opening ourselves up. But we have the heart of Christ in our body, in our church, and we are willing to be vulnerable and open ourselves up. These fears shouldn't be there. They shouldn't have any merit. Let's turn to Matthew 11, verse 27. It says here, Matthew 11, verse 27, all things are delivered unto me of my Father, and no man knoweth the Son but the Father, neither knoweth any man the Father save the Son, and he whomsoever the Son will reveal him. I'm going to read it in the chapter. Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you, and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and ye shall find rest unto your souls. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light. Back up to verse 27, it was saying how the Father knows the Son, and the Son knows the Father. And it also says, and he whomsoever the Son will reveal him. Now us as Christians, we have that personal connection to Christ. He has chosen to reveal himself to us. And talks later on how coming to Christ gives us rest for the laden and the heavy laden, the labor and heavy laden. And that's how we should be to each other. That's how we should be for the ones that are struggling. We should be like Christ, that heart of Christ, being willing to take and hear what people open up and share and be like Christ back to them. For we are like Christ for many people here on earth. Christ is living inside of us, and he doesn't judge us. He gives us the right, or he does not give us the right to judge others. One thing that really I was thinking about recently was that when we have are tempted or we struggle with something, God doesn't look down at us and think, oh, you little weakling. No, he's there to help us up. He's there to help build us up and pull us up. And that should be our same attitude towards others around us. All right, we're going to move on. Dysfunction number two is fear of conflict. Now, when you hear the word conflict, what do you think of?
Fighting.
It's good. Anyone else? What's that?
Disagreements.
Yeah, that's true. A lot of times we hear conflict, we think of negative terms right away, which in some ways it can be. The definition of conflict is an incompatibility between two or more opinions, principles, or interests. How many of you here like conflict? When you think of conflict, what do you think of? Or what do you like it? Anybody like conflict? You like conflict? When you're playing football, it's fun. It's a good thing. You there's conflicts there, yes. But no, conflict is not a bad thing. Conflict is needed. Productive conflict is needed. The problem with today, conflict is usually a negative term. Somebody doesn't like somebody, or they don't like what they're doing, or it's a negative form. It's almost, a lot of times it is a negative form. The problem is a lot of times conflict is avoided. No one likes the confrontation. They don't like it doesn't feel good. Conflict doesn't feel good. But conflict is needed. Patrick Lencioni, he's the guy that wrote the book, The Five Dysfunctions of a Team. He says, the desire to preserve artificial harmony stifles the occurrence of productive ideological conflict. Good conflict is not about winning a debate. It's about listening to someone else's ideas, considering their point of view, and understanding what they're saying. Doesn't mean you agree with them, but you have to sit there, listen, consider their point of view, take it to heart. And it doesn't mean you agree with them, but that's the point of conflict and going back and forth. As I was thinking about this, I really appreciate some of our men's meetings where we've hashed out ideas and direction and different things. And yes, we didn't always agree on the exact points, but we came together and found a direction and got on board. The reason that we need conflict is if people are not willing to open themselves up to share and give their points and discuss them, they're not going to feel heard. And if they're not heard, they're not going to buy into the idea or direction. Most people try to avoid conflict in order to try to keep some sense of harmony. Instead, it results in tensions where people are not able to speak And this ends up creating more politics and cliques. If people are willing to speak up and feel heard and discuss their ideas, discuss their point of views, and as a collaborative group form a decision, even the ones that didn't quite see eye to eye are going to buy into that idea because they felt they were heard and they felt part of the body and direction. This doesn't mean that feathers aren't going to get ruffled. They will. Or that people won't feel misunderstood. It's going to happen. But over time, as we practice conflict, in other words, I guess, productive conflict, we'll find ways of buying in together and finding direction and going forward. And you'll see as we go farther on, a lot of these points will start rolling into each other. Let's turn to Romans chapter 12. And verse 3, we're going to start in. For I say, through the grace given unto me, to every man that is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think so soberly, according as God hath dealt to every man the measure of faith. Keep going. As we have many members in one body, and all members have not the same office, so we, being many, are one body in Christ, and everyone members one of another, having then gifts differing according to the grace that is given unto us. Whether prophecy, let us prophesy according to the proportion of faith, or ministry, let us wait on our ministering, or he that teacheth on teaching, or he that exhorteth on exhortation. He that giveth, let him do it with simplicity. He that ruleth, with diligence. He that showeth mercy, with cheerfulness. Let love be without dissimulation. Abhor that which is evil. Cleave to that which is good. Be kindly affectionate one to another with brotherly love. In honor, preferring one another. Not slothful in business. Fervent in spirit. Serving the Lord. Rejoicing in hope. Patient in tribulation. Continuing instant in prayer. Distributing to the necessity of the saints, giving to hospitality. Bless them which persecute you, bless and curse not. Rejoice with them that do rejoice, and weep with them that weep. Be of the same mind one toward another. Mind not high things, but condescend to men of low estate. Be not wise in your own conceits. This is talking about different gifts, working together. And towards the beginning here, I'm going to find that verse again. I was talking about every man that is among you not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think. Now, that's where a lot of your conflict comes in. People thinking very highly of themselves, thinking they're right and everyone else is wrong. If we all have that mindset and we try to come to a meeting and discuss a direction, we're just going to keep knocking heads and walk away with nobody knowing what direction they want to go, or everyone knowing what direction they want to go but no one else agreeing with them. If we can come with a humbleness of heart, being willing to hear and share, we can come to a collaborated decision and have all buy-in from every member of the body, even though there is some disagreement there or some maybe not seeing quite eye to eye. All right, we'll move on to dysfunction number 3, is lack of commitment. So the lack of clarity or buy-in prevents the body from making decisions they will stick to. And you can see as we can go on, these things will keep building off of each other. You need trust to be productive in conflict. And without productive conflict, people won't feel they have been heard or buy into the direction of the church. Therefore, they won't commit to being part of the body. definition of commitment, I have two different definitions. The state of being dedicated to a cause. And number two is an agreement or pledge to do something in the future. So as a church, we find our direction, or we come together as a body, discuss different directions. We choose a direction. We have to trust each other, first of all, to even do that. We have to be not fear or be afraid of conflict to discuss our directions. And then once we do, we have to be commit to them, regardless of how we're feeling inside, or if we totally buy into the idea, or we will totally buy into the idea. Another quote from Patrick Lencioni says that most people don't have to get their way in a discussion. They just need to be heard and know that there is input. Their input was considered and responded to. In Acts chapter 2, verse 42, it says, and they continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine, in fellowship, and in breaking of bread and prayers. And fear came upon every soul, and many wonders and signs were done by the apostles. And all that believed were together and had all things in common, and sold their possessions and goods and parted them to all men, as every man had need. And they continued daily with one accord in the temple and breaking bread from the house to house. Did eat their meat with gladness and singleness of heart, praising God and having favor with all people, and the Lord added to the church daily such as should be saved. Here's talking about the apostles preaching, and as far as I know, there was a lot of people gathered together here, and they all had one heart, it says. And they basically sold all they had and gave it with one another. So they all had commitment to the body of Christ, to their body, their direction, where they were going. Let's turn to Colossians 3, verse 12. Put on, therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, bowels of mercies, kindness, humbleness of mind, meekness, and long-suffering, forbearing one another and forgiving one another. If any man have quarreling against any, even as Christ forgave you, so also do ye. And above all else, these things put on purity, which is the bond of perfectness. And let the peace of God rule in your heart, to which also ye are called in one body, and be thankful. Now, a lot of these things, and I'm talking about, you know, direction, but a lot of this comes down to just even just being a body. One towards another, we have to have forgiveness, we have to have love, we have to have commitment to each other, as well as the corporate direction of the church. Commitment is buying in and committing to a specific goal or direction, even if you don't agree with the decision. This point is vital because it's the primary cause of politics. When people don't feel heard, and if the decision fails, they go around saying, I never agreed on it anyway. And that's because they didn't, and they never bought into the direction of the body of the church. Do we have politics in church today? No. Yeah. We don't want to think so, but church is very political. There's a lot of politics going on in churches. I'm not saying that, you know, we don't have politics here, but other churches do. But that was a really good point, that if you don't buy in, if people don't feel they're heard or have the direction, that's where the politics comes from. Because they don't buy in, and then when things don't go right, well, they walk around saying, well, I never agree with that anyway. All right, we'll keep moving on here. Dysfunction number four is avoidance of accountability. As we continue, I'm not going to spend as much time on each of these points now, but Okay, the avoidance of accountability, the need to avoid interpersonal discomforts prevents members from holding each other accountable. If we do not trust each other, we will not have productive conflict. And without productive conflict, we will not have buy-in or commitment to the direction of the body. And without commitment, there will be no accountability. Once there is a clear sense of direction or goal, the body is able to approach and challenge one another on their behaviors, decisions, or directions, and they are going if it is against the direction of the body and the Bible. So once we trust each other and we no longer have fear of conflict, we have commitment to the body, and then we have accountability one to another. Let's turn to Hebrews chapter 10. We'll start in verse 19. For when Moses had spoken every precept to all the people according to the law, he took the blood of calves and of goats and with water and scarlet wool and hyssop and sprinkled both the book and all the people, saying, "This is the blood of the testament which God hath enjoined unto you. Moreover, he sprinkled with blood both the tabernacle and all the vessels of the ministry. And almost all things are by the law purged with blood, and without shedding of blood is no remission. It was therefore necessary that the patterns of things in the heavens should be purified with these, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these." Okay, these are not sounding right what I was looking for. I think I wrote down the wrong scriptures. Actually, I'm reading chapter 9. I'm sorry. Chapter 10, verse 19. Here we go. "Having therefore, brethren, boldness to enter onto the holiest by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way, which he had consecrated for us through the veil, that is to say, his flesh, and having a high priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a true heart and full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold fast the profession of our faith without wavering, for he is faithful that promised. And let us consider one another to provoke unto love and of good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as the manner of some is, but exhort one another, and so much more as you see the day approaching." Sorry about the first part. I had the wrong chapter. But anyway, it's talking here about exhorting one another, holding fast to the profession of our faith without wavering. And there is right into the whole accountability thing. What does accountability mean to you? Here's someone give a definition of that.
Someone that holds you up to something higher.
Someone that holds you up to something higher. That's good. Anybody else? Hold you to a commitment. Right. That's good. I like that. Who you can be, who you can become, right? That's good. But if someone comes to you, Steve, and tries telling you that you're not living up to your standards or what you can be, but you don't know this person or you don't really trust this person, are you going to listen to them? You're probably going to question their motives or what they're saying, right? And that's where a lot of these principles come in. Now we're going to jump now to dysfunction number 5, inattention to results. So in the church, do we focus on results, or should we focus on results? Absolutely. How do you know we're going anywhere or getting anywhere if we don't have any results? The pursuit of individuals' goals and personal status erodes the focus of collective success. So if we all come together and try doing our own things, we're not going to have success as a church. We're not going to have a good result as a body or as the complete gathering here. If we don't trust one another, we will not have productive conflict. Without productive conflict, we will not have buy-in or commitment to the body. And without commitment, there will be no accountability. And without accountability, you're not going to have any results. And without these things in place, we will struggle in our own personal lives to have victory. Because we don't have the support of the body or the church to help lift us up and overcome our struggles. And as a body, if we don't have these principles in place, we're not going to thrive or last long as a church. As I was thinking about this message, I was trying to think of how to incorporate a lot of this in the scripture, and another thought came to mind, something I've been learning or have learned a while back, and it just really started making sense to me recently, and that is actually the story of David and Goliath. So I'm going to actually run into that story real quick. I'm going to read the whole story real quick. It's a lot of reading, but bear with me on that. It'll come together later on. So we'll turn to 1 Samuel 17. And we're going to read the entire chapter. So, now the Philistines gathered together their armies to battle and were gathered together at Socho, I think I'm pronouncing that right, which belongeth to Judah, and pitched between Socho and Azekah. I don't like all these big words. And Ephesdamin, I think it is. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together and pitched by the valley of Elah, and set the battle in array against the Philistines. And the Philistines stood on the mountain on the one side, and Israel stood on the mountain on the other side, and there was a valley between them. And there went out a champion out of the camp of the Philistines named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. And he had a helmet of brass upon his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of brass. And he had greaves of brass upon his legs, and a target of brass between his shoulders. And the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear weighed 600 shekels of iron. And one bearing a shield went before him. And he stood and cried unto the armies of Israel, and said unto them, Why are ye come out to set your battle in array? Am not I a Philistine, and ye a servant to Saul? Choose a man for you, and let him come down to me. And if he be able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then shall ye be our servants and serve us. And the Philistine said, I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we might fight together. When Saul and all Israel heard these words, the Philistines, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Now David was the son of Ephrathite of Bethlehem, Judah, whose name was Jesse, and he had 8 sons. And the man went among men for an old man in the days of Saul. And the 3 eldest sons of Jesse went and followed Saul to the battle. And the names of his 3 sons went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn. Actually, I'm going to skip ahead here. This is a lot of just history. Okay, now David here, verse 22, he arrives at the camp. And 23, and as he talked with them, behold, there came up a champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, out of the armies of the Philistines. He spake according to the same words, and David heard them. And all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were sore afraid. And the men of Israel said, Have ye seen this man that has come up surely to defy Israel is he come up, and it shall be that man who killeth him, the king will enrich him with great riches, and will give him his daughter, and make his father's house free in Israel. And David spake to the men that stood by him, saying, what shall be done to the man that killeth this Philistine, and taketh away the reproach from Israel? For who is the uncircumcised Philistine, that he should defy the armies of the living God? And the people answered him after this manner, saying, so shall it be done to the man that killeth him. And Eliab, his eldest brother, heard what he spake unto the men. And Eliab's anger was kindled against David, and he said, why camest thou down hither, and with whom hast thou left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know thy pride and the naughtiness of thine heart, for thou art come down, that thou mightest see the battle. And David said, what have I done now, or now done? Is there not a cause? And he turned from him toward another, and spake after the same manner. And the people answered him again after the former manner. And when the words were heard which David spake, they rehearsed them before Saul, and he sent for him. And David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail because of him. Thy servant will go and fight with this Philistine. And Saul said to David, thou art not able to go against this Philistine to fight him, for thou art but a youth, and he a man of war from his youth. And David said unto Saul, thy servant kept his father's sheep, and there came a lion and a bear, and took a lamb out of the flock. And I went after him, and smote him, and delivered it out of his mouth. And when he arose against me, I caught him by his beard, and smote him, and slew him. Thy servant slew both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them, seeing he hath defiled the armies of the living God. David said, moreover, the Lord that delivereth me out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear, he will deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine. And Saul said unto David, go, and the Lord be with thee. And Saul armed David with his armor, and he put on helmet of brass upon his head. Also he armed him with a coat of mail. And David girded his sword upon his armor, and he essayed to go, for he had not proved it. And David said unto Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not proved them. And David put them off him. And he took his staff in his hand, and he chose 5 smooth stones out of the brook, and put them in a shepherd's bag, which he had even in a scrip. And his sling was in his hand. And he drew nigh to the Philistine. And the Philistine came on and drew near unto David. And the man that bare the shield went before him. And when the Philistine looked about and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth and ruddy and of a fair countenance. And the Philistine said unto David, Am I a dog that thou comest to me with staves? With sticks, in other words. And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, come to me, and I will give thy flesh unto the fowls of the air and to the beasts of the field. Then said David to the Philistine, thou comest to me with a sword and with a spear and with a shield, but I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of the Israel, and from whom thou hast defied. This day will the Lord deliver thee unto mine hand, and I will smite thee and take thine head from thee, and will give the carcass of the hosts of the Philistines this day unto the fowls of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth. And that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. And all this assembly shall know the Lord saveth not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you unto our hands. And it came to pass, when the Philistine arose and came and drew nigh to meet David, that David hastened and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand in his back, and took thence a stone, and slang it, and smote the Philistine in his forehead. And the stone sunk into his forehead, and he fell upon the face of the earth. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone, and smote the Philistine and slew him. But there was no sword in the hand of David. Therefore David ran and stood upon the Philistine, took his sword and drew it out of the sheath, and therefore and slew him, and cut off his head therewith. And when the Philistines saw their champion was dead, they fled. And the men of Israel and Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines until they came to the valley and the gates of Ekron. And the wounded of the Philistines fell down by the way of Sharim, even unto Gath and unto Ekron. I'm going to stop there. The story of David and Goliath, many of us know the story or have heard the story as an underdog story. So when you guys hear the story, what do you think of? Do you think of an underdog story? No? A lot of people do. It's David was overcame a giant feat. He overcame a giant. But as I studied this out, and I read a book one not long ago about it as well, but in those days, two armies would come together, and these armies were both close to equal. A lot of times, instead of them just dueling it out and losing a lot of men and a lot of blood, they will call their champions. They'll say, your champion face my champion. If you beat my champion, you win the war. If I beat your champion, we win the war. It was very common in those days because they fought so hand-to-hand combat. So this is what happened here. The Philistines came to battle, and instead of dueling it out in the middle of the field, the Philistines said, they drew their champion up, which is Goliath, and he was huge. And they said, all right, this is our champion. Now you bring one of your champions out to fight our champion. But since Goliath was so huge, no one wanted to face Goliath. And when, again, back in those days, back in history, when they called their champions out, it usually was an equal battle. So the man would come out with his sword, his spear, his shield, his armor, and they would fight hand to hand. The Israelites were sitting on the other side of the hill looking down at Goliath saying, none of us want to face this guy. It doesn't matter how strong we are. This guy is huge. He's going to beat us down. When David looked at Goliath, he did not consider himself going out there and fighting Goliath on his terms. David knew that he could never beat Goliath in Goliath's terms. If he went down there with a sword and a shield, there was no chance David was going to win. And that's why when Saul tried putting on his armor on David, David was like, I don't know this stuff. I can't fight in this. I don't want this. And he put it aside. So David goes out, and he chose his weapon, which was a sling, and went out to face Goliath. And in reality, Goliath was a giant, but in those days, there wasn't very many giants. There was a couple of giants. Goliath came from a family of giants. So most likely, Goliath actually had health problems. That's why he was so big. He was not a healthy, strong guy. I mean, he was big and was strong, yes, but he had a disorder called gigantism, and when you have gigantism, you can't see very well. You can see right in front of you, but that's it. So he was only strong and able to fight if someone was right there in front of him. From a distance, he sees blurry, most likely. This is some speculation, but so when David came towards Goliath, the only reason why I say that most likely giant Goliath couldn't see very well was he told David, he said, you're coming at me with sticks, multiple. David had one staff. So if Goliath sees him coming with multiple sticks, most likely he couldn't see very well, and he's probably seeing a couple different figures coming towards him. And that's why he also said, come to me, come here, because he wanted to fight him. And if he's back there, he can't quite see who he's fighting. David had a sling. And in those days, slings were like the artillery of the war. They fought with slings. Most of your armies had slingers. And a slinger could actually throw a stone farther than an arrow, than an archer can shoot an arrow. And he was more accurate at greater distances. So I'm just going to read a piece I found in a history article. Although the bow and the javelin are much more famous in ancient weapons, the sling was just as important to ancient skirmishers, due to the small size of its missiles, making them nearly invisible when released at such high velocities. The sling was particularly hard to defend against. This is especially true considering that the blunt trauma caused by the small stones upon impact could damage organs, shatter bones, and cause concussions or kill those struck in the head, even when the victim was armored. In the first century BC, the Roman medical writer Celsus stated that the sling stones could even penetrate skin and become lodged within a victim's body. The most skilled slingers of ancient world were even more accurate and had a far greater range than many archers, making them some of the most prized skirmishers available. It says also that a well-thrown sling had a stopping power, had more stopping power or equal to a 44 Magnum handgun today. So if you look back at the story of David and Goliath now, in that light, when Goliath finally realized that he's facing a slinger and not a swordsman, he was probably freaked out. Because now he realized, this little guy here has a lot upper hand than I do. I can't reach him. I can't hardly see him. I can't hit him. And he could just throw stones at me. And like I said, a well-placed stone will take off or kill somebody. So David, when he attacked Goliath, he had the accuracy of better than an archer. He hit Goliath in the forehead with a stone, and most likely it said that stone sunk in. So that stone went into his head. And most likely he was probably dead before he even hit the ground. And David came up and cut off Goliath's head. When we read this story, so many times it's used as an underdog story, saying that David stood up for what was right and he slew Goliath. The way I look at the story now is David changed the name of the game. He changed what was expected of him to do. Goliath called him out, called somebody out, and said, "Fight me with hand-to-hand combat." David came out with a sling and said, "No, I'm gonna kill you with a sling." And thinking about this principle of changing the name of the game, and I read that book on it, and I could never really figure out how to put it into practical life, of how I would put it in my life, how to change the name. And I was reading and studying this over the five dysfunctions of a team, the trust, conflict, commitment. When the devil comes at us individually, he comes and attacks me individually, human tension or human reaction normally is to hold these things in because we don't want people to know that we're struggling with this issue, whether it be lust or anything else, thoughts in our mind. I don't want to go and lay myself out and say, "People, I'm struggling with this issue," and people might think I'm different. So I keep that inside. The devil knows that. If we're facing temptation, we're facing struggles, and we keep these things inside, the devil has the upper hand. We're fighting him on his turf, and he knows he has the upper hand. But when we come to church, we be vulnerable, we open ourselves up. Now it's not just me versus these temptations or the devil. Now it's us versus the devil. And he has no chance to fight. So I thought it was really awesome, this principle of changing the name of the game. Let's work together as a collaborative body. Let's be willing to open ourselves up, be vulnerable, trust each other with what we're going through in our lives, so together we can make that impact. So thank you.
Thank you, Dave.